Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, if you loved how novelist Maria Semple conjured up Seattle in her 2012 book, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Your days of waiting for her next work are over. She says the advice of a friend gave her the inspiration she needed.
Maria, you're a writer. Writers must write. If you do not write, you will become a menace to society. And in that moment, I thought, I know what my book is. My next book is me being a menace to society.
If there's such a thing as loving menace, this is it. Maria Semple's new book is Today Will Be Different. She spoke at an Elliott Bay Book Company event at Town Hall Seattle on October 8th, 2016. Thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording. Here, Elliott Bay's Rick Simonson introduces Maria Semple.
On behalf of everyone at Elliott Bay, we are all delighted that you're here and extremely delighted and excited that we are here tonight on the occasion of Maria Semple, who is actually started since this wonderful new book, Today Will Be Different, got published, was out of town with it. So tonight's really the beginning of her home city celebration and publication of this book. We've been talking backstage, everything from... It is interesting that Maria has now had three novels, and each of them has been done in an election year. This one is mine, was a little overshadowed by Barack Obama initially getting elected, so that may be understandable. But what happened 4 years ago when Where'd You Go, Bernadette was published, we certainly had this great initial response in this book that had Seattle and all these goings on at its heart. And then we were realizing everyone else in the country also was on to this book. And so that book, and of course that election didn't have quite as much going on in it in terms of drama, certainly in this state where no one even comes to campaign, it took off. And now in a year where we really need some relief and release from things, it's the timing of this book is auspicious. And I think, but to leave the election alone, just to say it is a book that, unlike 4 years ago where we had our sort of, I think we had a little sense of this book to ourselves before everyone else was onto it, this book, this time people really elsewhere do know what she has done and is doing. And this has been manifest in reviews coming out, and you will, as you have gotten your copies tonight, we'll get to see in this day in the life of Eleanor Flood and her husband Joe and her son Timby, and all that happens in Seattle with some detours into past and other places. But it's a marvelous and book that does have its humor, but also, as Where'd You Go, Bernadette also does, for all the talk of the humor in the book, has these other telling kernels of life truth and which are not always easy and funny, except sometimes that point where things are so serious that you have to laugh. And what Eleanor is trying to figure out in her life, from the most kind of basic things of how to, you know, get life redirected in the way we all try and do, to bigger questions, are things that Maria writes about here. It's a book that has many pleasures in it. It's got, in the middle of it, there's a graphic novel or a graphic narrative form that Eric Chase Anderson, I believe, is, if you read the credits, did the artwork for. But it also has original artwork by her daughter, Poppy Meyer. Poppy is here. Yes. Maybe afterwards Poppy will also help sign. We'll see. But it's a marvelous book. The other things I can go on about the book, but the best part is you're going to get to hear Maria do the book. But I want to say a little in the time that we've gotten to know Maria and George and Poppy since they've been really become part of Seattle, is this other part they've done. I mean, writing these books is the most amazing thing. But there's also been this great and remarkable thing of helping, you know, everything from supporting other writers to supporting many of the other literary enterprises around around the city and around and elsewhere in the country, and being very connected and supportive in this sort of behind-the-scenes way that you don't always see of support for other writers, including very unknown writers. I mean, it's easier to sometimes, you know, with someone who's sort of well-known to jump on that kind of a bandwagon. But Maria's shown up at the LA Bay for less-known writers and sort of, you know, turned around and said, have you read this book? I mean, she's one of those people when you have these conversations, she sort of, you're kept on your toes because, you know, she's active and taking things in. I will also say she's also been a great supporter and champion for all of us who work in bookstores, our own, you know, and elsewhere, independent stores, as there have been various swirling controversies about the book business. And I can tell you one short Maria story, or of many one could tell, but a few years ago when they had one of those days where the book authors come into bookstores to sell books. I mean, they would recommend books as an indie's first day that Sherman Alexi here actually helped initiate this whole idea. And Maria was in the store, and you could hear across the way, you know, she's going, what are you doing? Are you taking pictures of these books? Are you going to buy them at Amazon? You know, she would just, you heard this across the store. And we've seen this happen. We are sometimes like, oh God, this is happening. But Maria was calling them on it. And tiptoeing around it. She was going right for it. In a way, we all were going, yes. But we all were trying to, well, you know, sort of, Maria, that's, being, you know. But she carries that heartfulness with her throughout life, and as far as I know, and certainly all of us as we get to know her, and certainly in these books. So tonight she'll read from and talk about today will be different, and then she will take questions. We have microphones here for that. And then the books you got as you come in, most of them, I believe, are signed, but she will personalize. So she'll sit at this table here. I will say one last thing, because of this day of rain and gray and bluster, Maria also, you know, she has these things, and one of the things about this book coming into it was its cover. And I remember we some of us got to see different ideas of the cover, and she got the cover she wanted. And if you look, it's a gray on gray. I mean, it's, you know, this is a Seattle cover with some green in it. It's you don't get gray on gray. But the New York publishing people were trying to go, oh no, it's got to be yellow. It's got to be something bright, and it does have an orange spine. But it's the most Seattle cover you can get. You know, bless Maria for that. You know, doing all that. So, thank you all again for being here tonight. And now please join in welcoming our very wonderful and special and dear Maria Semple. Oh.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick. And I want to especially thank all of you for coming out and spending this night with me to kill 2 hours before tomorrow night's debate. Of all the things you could be doing to kill time, thank you. I wrote Where'd You Go, Bernadette? From a place of a lot of emotional pain. I had just moved to Seattle. I'd had a book published that I naively thought would just sell well, and I was naive. I didn't realize that most books, when you write them, they don't get reviewed and they kind of go away. And I'd come from TV, where everyone kind of knew what show you were working on and knew what you did. And so when I had this book called My First Book, This One Is Mine, that came out that kind of died, I felt this terrible public shame, which actually was irrational, but I felt that. You know, I could talk myself into, oh no, there's no shame in writing a book, and you have a good publisher, and at least you proud that you could have a book with your name on in the bookstore, and isn't that accomplishment enough? But it wasn't. And so instead of taking responsibility for myself, I decided to blame an entire city of people I didn't know, which was you. And I would be kind of nursing my humiliation and driving around the streets of Seattle and cursing the drivers and cursing the mothers at school and just cursing anything that came in my way. And I was talking to a friend of mine and ranting on about Seattle and how much I couldn't stand it here and how I'd never write again, that I was such a failure. And he said to me, "Maria, you're a writer. Writers must write. If you do not write, you will become a menace to society." And in that moment, I thought, I know what my book is. My next book is me being a menace to society. If I never got over this sense of self-pity, this kind of toxic blaming of other people for something they didn't do. I was about to take a shot at you people with gray hair, but I didn't. See? Isn't that nice? It was so easy. It was. I'm like Donald Trump. I could have done it. I didn't. And so I knew what the book was, and I wrote it, and it just came out in this burst, and it was very specific, and it felt like this act of madness that it was so specific and strange, and I didn't try to make it at all relatable. I just wanted to make it so pure to what my emotional experience was, and then I just let my imagination fly. And so Bernadette came out, obviously, and it did well, and people liked it. And so it solved the big problem, which was that, poor me, I'm not a successful writer. And then suddenly I was a successful writer. I had a new book to write, and I had nothing to complain about or to suffer about. You would think, but somehow people can clutch unhappiness out of the circumstances of happiness. And so I trusting that I could find something to write about, but not knowing what it was, not knowing what the new book would be. And at this point, the book was, I think, a year and a half overdue, so I really had to get on it. I decided that I would just sit down and try to see if I could tap into some kind of rich vein of unhappiness that could be my fuel that I could base a book on. And I thought, let's just see what's in there. You know, let's just, well, I would say for a moment, put aside the fact that I have nothing to complain about, but maybe that lasted for more than a moment, but on most days. But so I went into my writing room, I got out my yellow pad and my sharpened pencils, which is how I write, and it was before my family was awake, and I went at about 5:30 or 6 in the morning, and I just thought, let's just see what's in here, what's the part of me that I'm very ashamed of, that I feel really bad about, that I don't want the world to see. And what I wrote turned out to be the first page of my book. And I really had no idea that I was writing the first page of a book, but I'm going to read to you, this is almost verbatim, what I wrote that morning. And the names have been changed to protect the innocent. "Today will be different. Today, I will be present. Today, anyone I'm speaking to, I will look them in the eye and listen deeply. Today, I'll play a board game with Timby. I'll initiate sex with Joe. Today, I will take pride in my appearance. I'll shower, get dressed in proper clothes, and only change into yoga clothes for yoga, which today, I will actually attend. Today, I won't swear. I won't talk about money. Today there will be an ease about me. My face will be relaxed, its resting place a smile. Today I will radiate calm. Kindness and self-control will abound. Today I will buy local." See, I always have to get the digs in. "Today I will be my best self, the person I'm capable of being. Today will be different." And I thought, wow, I think that I'm now going to write a book that takes place in a day about a woman who doesn't have a lot of problems, yet is deeply disappointed in herself and feels like every day on a microtransactional level is just a series of personal failures. And so then I just thought, that sounds fun, and I'll spend 2 years doing that. So I spent 2 years on that, and I it follows Eleanor Flood over the course of a day, this day that she vows she's just not going to make the world a better place. In fact, she says all she wants to do is not make the world a worse place. So it's a very modest goal that she sets for herself, very low bar. And so a lot of stuff happens during the course of the day. But it is essentially an ordinary day. And I played with the form, you'll see. There's some fun stuff in it. There's a big third-person section, there's a graphic novel, there's poems, there's various kind of fun things in here. So the next section I'm going to read is, it takes place kind of in the middle of the book, but it's not giving much away, and it doesn't give more away that's on the flap copy, which is what we in publishing call that stuff, on the inside of the on the flap. But so I feel like I can tell you enough about this. So basically, what one of the things that happens is she thinks that her husband Joe might be having an affair. That something happens that makes her go into a scenario in her mind by which he could be having an affair, and then she thinks that actually it might really be happening, and it's the first time that she's kind of dealing with this realization that this actually could be the case. And so just to set up the scene, she's with her dog Yo-Yo. What I really should have done is brought my dog Ralphie, because he's Yo-Yo. He's so cute, but you would have just ignored me because he's too cute. So she's with her dog Yo-Yo, and she is walking in the sculpture park, and she's by the water. Now, it's very true to Seattle, except for things like there's a Costco over next to the sculpture park. But don't hate me. I know there isn't one. And also, that's where the squid boats come in, which I don't think is the case. But so in my Seattle, there's a Costco over there, and that's where the squid boats come in. And so there's a boat that's come in that has a tattooed chef, as Eleanor says. Are there any other kinds? A tattooed chef is buying a squid from the fishing boat, and this has been going on, and she's kind of noticed them. And meanwhile, she's there with her dog, and she's just we're in her head. And so here I'm going to read this part. Joe is her husband. For years, I'd been cataloging traits of Joe's that annoyed me, things I'd be relieved to have out of my life should he ever decide to leave me. The gratitude list, I called it. Number one. When I get out of the shower and ask Joe to hand me a towel, he'll invariably hand me a damp one. Two, he has never once offered to walk Yo-Yo. He'll walk Yo-Yo, but only after making me play the harridan. Number three, when we go out to restaurants, he puts uneaten dinner rolls in his socks so they don't go to waste. Number four, said dinner rolls get placed on his bedside table until he notices them a week later, at which point he hands them to me and asks me to, quote, use them in something. Number five, every time we go to a movie and it starts 20 minutes late because of the previews, Joe goes nuts, showing me his watch, informing me and everyone else in the theater what time the movie was scheduled to begin. Number six, when we run a fan to cool down a room, he insists it point facing into the room, not out, which just seems wrong. Number seven, he puts sriracha on everything I make, even waffles. My gratitude list was self-protection. I started composing it the morning after Joe and I first said, I love you, at Dojo's on St. Mark's Place. Bob Marley's Legend was playing in the background. This was New York in the 90s. When wasn't Legend playing in the background? Joe was due at the hospital at 5:30 a.m. He'd showered and dressed quietly enough, but then he sat at the end of my bed, on my feet, and put on his shoes. Just so you don't take me for a complete scorekeeping bitch, which I am, but there's better evidence, Joe freely admits he's essentially selfish. It's the single piece of insight he received the one time he went to a shrink. Me, on the other hand, I've been to 9 shrinks in 20 years, and I'm still like, wait, what? This selfishness, according to Joe's miracle shrink, was a response to being one of 7 children. Every time a box of Quisp or Quake was unpacked from the grocery bag, kids descended on it in a feeding frenzy. Joe shared a room with 3 brothers. Control of the TV remote, a private place to read Playboy, everything a cage match to the death. The fault, of course, lay with the Catholic Church, who encouraged lower class families to reproduce like rodents and build up the church's ranks, blah, 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 blah. Another item for the gratitude list, no more Joe railing against religion. In fact, that dinner at Dojo's, it wasn't Rasta Bob singing, "I'm gonna love you every day and every night," that inspired Joe to declare the 3 words that sealed our fate. It was the following discussion of the New Testament. Joe, it's doggerel, aggrandizing a moody egomaniac, written by men who believed heaven was 100 feet above their heads. Literally, so when Christ descended, he didn't go higher than a 7-story building. Me, who cares? Joe, the hours I wasted listening to that contradictory claptrap, the things I could have done with that time, I could have learned another language or leathercraft. Me, I was brought up Catholic too, you know. When I was 7, they were teaching us about the loaves and the fishes. I raised my hand and said, that couldn't really happen. Sister Bridget, not happy, answered, faith requires the mind of a child. I said, but I am a child. She replied, a younger child. I thought, what a load of malarkey, and never looked back. Joe, so you just turned atheist? Wasn't it a struggle? Me, let's nod and say we did is my attitude. Joe, I love you. Me, I knew it was a blurt that didn't count, but still, you gotta jump on these things. I love you too, Joe. Had I lost him, might there be someone else? Now we're back into the present, and she's back in, on the sculpture garden where the squid boats come in my Seattle. Yo-Yo's eyes were closed and his face was raised to the sun. The fisherman helped the tattooed chef load the squid into an ice chest. I caught them looking at me. Had they been talking about me? I gave them a nod. They carried on their business. I revisited my gratitude list. Oh, another one. Joe reads in bed long after I go to sleep. No amount of passive-aggressive tossing and turning on my part, nor looking at the clock, nor dramatically putting a pillow over my head will make him turn off the light. When he finally does, he'll sometime rest his book on me. And these aren't slim volumes of poetry. They're Winston Churchill biographies. And Winston Churchill lived a very full life. The van door slammed. The fisherman was gone. The chef came around the side. Our eyes caught. I held my gaze. So did he. It's not that I wanted to get anything going with this guy, but this was too weird. And then he was walking towards me with an intrigued half smile. I don't put my hair in a clip for one day and this happens? A hot chef, knowing he's got a squid in the back of his van, boldly crosses a parking lot to start up a conversation with a middle-aged woman? This brave new world could not have come at a better time. I have to ask, he said. I have to answer. What kind of dog is this? I was as desirable as a hedge. That's what happens when you lose your sex drive. I can put on Belgian dresses, wear my hair down, and flirt garishly. But when it came to real currency, sexual currency, I had none. I offered the chef the leash. He's a mutt, I said. Want him? Wow, he said. No. But thanks, he sure is cute. With that, my gentleman caller disappeared into the ether. It's not like I don't come with my own grab bag of flaws. Although Joe is far too superior to catalog his grievances towards me, they might include: 1, once I ate a bagel on the toilet. 2, I use too much floss. 3, I floss in bed. 4, I take the dog into the shower with me to wash him. 5, I take my first bite of popcorn at the movies by touching my tongue to the top of the popcorn and eating what sticks. But Joe always says he doesn't want popcorn because it's too salty. So it's mine, and can I eat it the way I want? 6, I toss milk duds into the popcorn. 7, actually, I bite the milk duds into 4 pieces and spit them back into the popcorn. So they're smaller, giving me a better popcorn to milk dud ratio. Yes, they're covered in saliva, but it's my saliva. Though I can see how, to someone reaching into the popcorn they said they weren't going to eat, it could be an issue. Joe wouldn't say this because he's a gentleman, but I will. I'm looking worse by the day. I'm all jowly. My back is dry. I have a bush the size of a dinner plate. My core strength is non-existent. Menopause means your metabolism skids to a stop and you lose 30% of your muscle mass. In other words, the self-discipline to watch my weight, which I never had to begin with, I would now need more of. Really, I'm hanging by a thread. Even Yo-Yo, bored with the hot sun, let out a snorty yawn. Come on, gratitude list, work your magic. I haven't nursed you all these years for nothing. The whole idea was when Joe finally hit the eject button, I'd feel free too. Kind of like that first shower after getting my hair chopped off. Those first steps in a new pair of cushiony running shoes. Seeing the world through a new, stronger prescription lens. Could this be happening? Could the elixir I'd been squirreling away for decades have lost its fizz? Was it me? Was it Joe? Was it the passage of time? Was I too tired to care? Earlier this year, I told a mother at school I'd been married 15 years. She asked, "What's the secret to a long marriage?" I thought for a second, then answered, "Staying married." Was it happiness I'd found in my long marriage, or capitulation? Or is that all happiness is, capitulation? The story of our marriage was in frames all over our apartment. Joe and I riding to the Emmys in the back of a limo. Me surprising Joe during his residency in Chicago and having someone take our picture in front of Cy Twombly's peonies. Our wedding in Violet Perry's backyard in Martha's Vineyard. Giving birth to Timby at home on Thanksgiving Day. But standing there in the weak October sun, a different story of our marriage presented itself. It was as if all those years, Joe and I had been followed by a photographer snapping pictures of us unawares. Joe and me reading quietly in bed, Timby playing Legos at our feet. Me looking out the window, seeing Joe and Timby below, walking home from the Science Center. Me standing on the Gaylor Street lawn in the drizzle, early for pickup. Yo-Yo snoring in the living room, so loud none of us could sleep. The three of us sitting on the curb outside Portage Bay, waiting for them to call our name for brunch. I'm sorry. That was happiness, not the framed greatest hits, but the moments between. At the moment, I didn't peg them as being particularly happy. But now, looking back at those phantom snapshots, I'm struck by my calm, my ease, the evident comfort with my life. I'm happy in retrospect. Oh, Joe, take me back, and I promise I'll make love to you twice a week and never eat a bagel on the toilet again. Thank you. Thank you very much. I think I'm going to do Q&A now, because if just a couple questions, it'll get us to the end, because I can talk if you haven't noticed. So does anyone have questions? And then is anyone brave enough to be the first? This is where my friends, you're here. You need to step up. Yes. Yes.
What is your first thing you wrote?
In this book? Or in life? Oh, in life, the first thing that I wrote was a daily newspaper for when my parents were out at dinner parties and plays. And I would write a newspaper, and my father was a screenwriter. He had an Olympia typewriter, and I would type out on the typewriter the events of the household, like cat eats dinner, and then I'd draw a picture of it. There was no take on it. There was no kind of... It was just the few basic things that happened, and then I would put it on their pillows for when they got home. So that's the first thing I wrote. Other questions? Yes.
Maria, in Bernadette, Seattle was a big character. Talk about that in this book.
This book, I actually think Seattle is... Eleanor's going around Seattle in a very real way, and I it was very important to me to literally time out the routes that she was taking, you know, so that I knew that she could go from one place to another. And there's a lot of greatest hits of Seattle in the book. I just saw that I think Seattle Magazine just did a map of this book of Eleanor's Seattle, and it showed all the her spots, and it was I thought it was really cute. And so Eleanor doesn't have an antagonistic relationship towards Seattle. She's just in it. She's just really boots in the mud, kind of going through the day. And Seattle, it's very real, other than the Phantom Costco over by the Magnolia Bridge. It's all pretty real. And so I felt like in Bernadette, you know, the weird thing that happens is you write these books, and they're very personal to you, and you can... you know exactly what they are to you, and then you put them out in the world and they become something else. And it never occurred to me I was writing a book about Seattle with Bernadette. It never occurred to me I was writing a book about private school parents, or, you know, I didn't know that. I just thought, oh, I'm just trying to get this right, trying to get the details right. And so with Bernadette, I really, to me, Seattle was kind of a tool. It was that she was mentally, her relationship with Seattle was really bad in the beginning, where she blamed Seattle for all of her problems. And then the beginning of the book, she was a victim. And then at the end, she took responsibility. That was kind of my invisible character arc for her. And so by the end, she loves Seattle, because I felt like that was a way of showing that she was healthy, you know, that she wasn't in this fight with Seattle. And so with this book, I'd say I don't think that Eleanor dislikes Seattle exactly. I think she gets annoyed. She gets annoyed at everything, but she, you know, she doesn't like the hummus at Jazz Alley. I feel terrible that I put that in, but... but, you know, so there's things that, you know, no city's perfect, right? There's not every place makes great hummus, but, and you just, sometimes you gotta expose it for what it is. So it's just kind of in passing, her attitude about things. But she has lunch at Mam Noon. There's a lot of, she has breakfast at Lola. She should be on some dining club program, because, I mean, she's going to all the restaurants. Just because I love the restaurants and I want to put all the restaurants in. I still have not gotten one plate of free food, but hopefully one day. But so she hits a lot of the good restaurants, and she hits, you know, in Gaylor Street, in the beginning of the book. The Gaylor Street School, from Where'd You Go, Bernadette, is now Bernadette's old house. At the top of Timby Goes to School at the Gaylor Street School, which I'd say if you're smart, you'd recognize it. But now it's if you have hearing, you would recognize it, because I'm telling you that the top of the hill where Jimmy goes to school is Gaylor Street School, is Bernadette's old house. And so it's been redone and turned into a school. And in fact, Bernadette makes a little cameo that you can see her or not. But no, she's not even, sorry, gosh, now I feel bad. You're going to be totally let down. Is you'll see her in the background, maybe, or not. Oh, my gosh, I have to quickly put in some edits before the next printing. that's some Bernadette hits. Oh, my God, what did I do? So I do love Seattle. You know, I love it here, and I think that because when I write, I feel very loose when I write, and I am just throwing anything that happens to me that day. And when these books, even this book now, it's still very raw to me, but in 2 months it'll feel like this snapshot from the past, you know, because if I'm writing a book, just be careful about any conversation you have with me, because it's going in the book, you know? And it's just boom, boom, boom. I'm just like, isn't there like a Muppet chef who's just throwing everything in the stew? That's kind of what I'm like when I'm writing a book. And so if I'm going around Seattle or don't like the hummus at a particular place, you know what? It's going to get hurt. So I'll just throw it in. Okay, thank you for the question. Yes? Indeed, yes. I didn't like Seattle at first. The question was about not liking Seattle. And, you know, I was going to save this passage for the end, but I'm going to read it now because it feels like it's asking to be read now. It's just a little piece. This kind of answers the question. So Eleanor is from New York. I'm from L.A., but I lived in New York for a long time. And so Eleanor's from New York, and she's originally from New York, and she's talking about when she first moved to Seattle. Right after Joe and I moved to Seattle, we went to the State Fair, my first ever. It has since become a tradition. Of course, this native New Yorker was horrified at the parolee vibe and average weight of my fellow milling attendees. Around every corner, teardropped trailers sold raspberry scones. Pride of Washington, the signs beamed. I thought, how sad for Washington State to be proud over so little. Such could also be said of the entertainment offered. We were expected to marvel over goats in pens, be amazed at vegetables arranged to look like the Washington State flag, gather around for jewelry cleaning demos. I must have been on my feet too long, or maybe it was the September heat, but when I saw the genuine delight Joe took in cheering his entry in a pig race, look at that, they're chasing an Oreo. My defenses went kaput. I actually felt at one with the doughy white mass of humanity, these Washingtonians with their guns and Jesus and blue blockers. And I thought, how sad for you, New York City, you self-obsessed crack whore. You're self-absorbed crack whore with your status-obsessed, edgy, darting eyes, your choked sidewalks, your cancerously reproducing Starkitect-designed Prada stores, your breathless yak about real estate prices drowning out all civilized conversation, your deafening restaurants impossible to get into, your cheap TV stars muscling out real talent on Broadway, your smelly streets clogged with blacker SUVs with darker tinted windows ferrying richer and richer hedge fund creeps. And where does it leave you? Still chasing yesterday's high. In that moment, I loved our new life in dumpy Washington State. And especially Joe for dragging me here and saving me from my Manhattan-centric worst self. So that's the answer to your question. So, yeah, that's kind of how I put it. Yes?
Has anybody ever
Yes. And I'll tell you that I would say people I like and dislike equally. You know, what I do really is that I have my main characters that I always start with, and they're really kind of a version of me. And that's where I start. And then you have to kind of construct the world around. I have to construct the world around her for maximum drama. You know, and it can't just be like all these really nice people, because then I wouldn't have a story. You know, I want to tell like a page-turning kind of crazy, wild story. And so what I do is I start populating the book with people who are going to push the buttons of my character. And so in Bernadette, that would be Audrey, that would be Sue Lynn. You know, these were the people. Now, and how I do it is I usually start with just a... like I come up with what I call a handle on the character, like, you know, and often I think of it in the negative of the main character. So if Bernadette is iconoclastic and doesn't care what people think, Audrey really cares what people think and cares above all, will go out of her way to conform. And so when you put those two in a room together, you're going to get tension and you're going to get, you know, there's story possibility there for them to clash. And so, you know, when it comes to the negative characters, if you say, it's not like purely I say, oh, here's a really bad person that I'm putting in my book. I'm really thinking in terms of the story potential. And often what I'm doing is I'm boiling it down to the essence of somebody. You know, if it's, and I'd say in almost every case, the people I'm writing about wouldn't even recognize necessarily themselves in it. You know, it's just a very specific take. Like, and often I would say that Audrey, to go to where you go, Bernadette, for instance, is someone who I really relate to. Like, I feel like I am Audrey, you know? And in this book, the antagonist would be, in a way, a former colleague of Eleanor's, and I feel like I'm very much the former colleague of Eleanor's. I wrote that from a very personal point of view. So I'd say yes, that I do. You have to put the negative in your book. You know, I really think that you do. I think you wouldn't have a story if there were not flawed people. I mean, that's, I think, the better way of looking at it, is what is the character flaw. And I think everyone has character flaws, so you want to try to, in a like a mad scientist, you want to get the cocktails of the character flaws, you know, combined, so it feels really explosive. Yes?
I know you based some of your characters on your family. Did you allow them or make them read the book before?
yes. Well, I... yes, they... I mean, I think that as I'm writing it, it's certainly George and Poppy. They know what I'm writing, and I think they know enough that I'm writing not them, because the scenario is so different. You know, I really do. I mean, I think I'm kind of making too much of how auto... I mean, I read two, like, pretty autobiographical parts right now, but the stories are so different. You know, the stories of the characters are different, and the circumstances are different, and none of that is autobiographical. And so I think that I do ask them. You know, I do say I'm going to write this, and that's okay, and they're very game and very supportive, I will say, and they're very nice about it. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put it in without asking them. Poppy, you haven't finished this book, right? No, she's yeah, look at her shaking her head. No, and she, Bernadette, I think she wasn't particularly smitten by either. So just don't have a fan in the household. If she would read the books, then I would ask her what she thought of her depiction in them. But I guess we won't be having that conversation. So, yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of it is kind of the emotion that I'm feeling that I feel like belongs to me, and then I kind of put it on a scenario that doesn't necessarily line up with reality. But I have some very game people in the house. Thank you. Yes.
What was going on for you in your head to think about Antarctica?
Mm-hmm.
And did
Yes, so the question is about Antarctica and where you go, Bernadette. And yes, I did go to Antarctica. And so what that was about was that when I was writing Where'd You Go, Bernadette, I just moved to Seattle. We just started a new school, and I was going to Antarctica because we travel a lot, and I like taking cool trips. And there's one person who I trust more than anybody who just said, I came back from the best place I've ever been, and it was Antarctica. And so I thought, okay, let's figure out how to go there. So we were planning on going to Antarctica. And then when I would tell people at school, right when we'd first moved from L.A., and they were like, I guess, I don't know what they were doing for Christmas, but when I said I was going to Antarctica, I think they just felt like punching me, you know, I don't know. And so when I was starting to write about this outsider, I thought, oh, I should just make her go to Antarctica, because apparently it really pisses people off in Seattle when you go to Antarctica for Christmas. And so I just thought that would be a fun place to start, you know, and I didn't really think much of it, you know. I just, again, it was like just threw in some spice. Hey, I throw in some Antarctica. And I had some social anxiety about the Antarctica, because the way Bernadette did, and she starts out having social anxiety, and it was, you know, it was like, oh, this incredible opportunity, and what a privilege to go. And I was like, do we have to sit with people for dinner? Because I'm not going, you know. And so I used that part of myself in it, you know. And so I kind of constructed it, and I didn't know really where the narrative was going at that point. But I just kind of pointed the family in the direction of Antarctica. And then I went to Antarctica in the middle of writing it. I do write in order, you know, so I was maybe halfway through. And then when we went down there, I really loved it. And I really was open. You're down there and you're not thinking about your book. It's just really trippy and, you know, beautiful. And you're thinking about a lot of other stuff. And then this thing happened where, I left the boat to go on a Zodiac, you know, a little Zodiac trip, as we all do. And then when I came back, I scanned my ID card, and it said, go see the front desk, because you scan on the way out and scan on the way in. And then I went in and I said, oh, they told me to come up, and they said, well, your ID didn't scan. The boat didn't know you left. And then the TV writer in me, you know, the plot person in me went, oh, the boat doesn't know I left. I think maybe I can use that, you know. So that kind of was my only reason. I don't think it was for that encounter with my scanning card at the front desk I would have even put the novel in that direction, you know. But it just, I thought that was such an ingenious and real moment that I could possibly use. And then the whole narrative kind of spun out from that moment. You know, so yeah, I loved it, and I'm glad. It was one of those things I just threw in, and I'm very glad. You know, I went and I thought, oh, I better take notes when I'm down here. And then when I really did use Antarctica, I was like, oh, good, I have that notebook. And then the notebook had like three lines in it; it had nothing in it. I was so mad at myself, so I had to close my eyes and really try to remember. So that was hard. Yes. Oh, no, don't ask me that. What are you, my mother? No. Isn't this enough for you? Come on. This is my second speaking thing about this book. Come on, give me a break. No, I'll tell you, well, first of all, just to really annoy you, is it only took me about a year to write this book, because I'm a really fast writer, and it took me a year to write Bernadette and a year to write this book. And so what I do is I speed through a first draft, and that takes about 3 months. And then I take a time off and then just rewrite, then take time off, then rewrite. And I don't know what it is, but I don't start writing until I really feel like I have a lot of energy. And I know that's why it was important for me for Bernadette to kind of tap into that vein. And with this book too, you know, I really wasn't going to sit down and try to, you know, just invent something out of nothing. I needed it to come from this deep place. And once I wrote that first page, And it really made me sick. It made me just sicken with myself and upset, you know, that like that. And it felt like very risky to write that book, you know, because it really was pushing up against why would anyone care, or someone who has no real problems. And it seemed like such a suicide mission, you know, to write that book, that I got excited about it, you know, because you have to, you know, go, God, what am I doing? I've lost my mind, you know, and I like having that kind of energy. And so so it didn't take me very long. And what I think I'm going to do now is take about 2 years off, or maybe 3 years off. And then, but you know, I say that, and then hex many years from now, the story will be, so I thought I was going to take 3 years off to write a book. I mean, you just don't know how it's going to work. But all I do know is I'm not writing a book right now. I'm tired is what I am. And I'm watching Donald Trump on TV is what's going on right now. So, yeah, there's no books being written right now.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum featuring novelist Maria Semple. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.